I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. What else was happening in 2016? Besides Clinton v. Trump, that is. The news from London this week is that before any new American president serves her or his four-year term, the 50-year span, 1970 to 2020, will have killed off half the world's wildlife, animal and vegetable, and maybe two-thirds of the vertebrate population. It doesn't come up in the campaign debates at all, and not much elsewhere. Network News, we discover, gave Tom Brady's Deflategate twice as much attention last year and this as the coughing fit in our stormy skies. Carbon pollution keeps rising, along with the Earth's temperature, and somehow we find ways to talk and fight about almost anything but the critical condition of our only habitat. Amitav Ghosh leads our conversation this hour, anthropologist and epic novelist of empires then and now, a world-wandering note-taker, born and schooled in India, a New Yorker by now. He says we're suffering a disease of the imagination, artists and writers especially. 50 years from now, says Amitav Ghosh, people will look back from a withering planet and ask how novelists like him missed the story of our times, a human and non-human event as big as the biblical flood.
This is completely different, yes. This is completely different. But, you know, it's not as if there isn't any precedent in fiction for dealing with the non-human. If you just think about Moby Dick, I mean, Moby Dick, really, one of the protagonists is non-human. I mean, the whale is non-human. And I think it's in these ways that Melville really was so brilliant and really so prescient about the world. But the problem really is that Melville's kind of writing isn't done anymore. You know, if we think about what really happened in the 20th century, it's that novelists, artists, everybody moved away from these wider engagements with nature, with our environment, with our surroundings. Artists have moved away from that.
You credit rightly Tolstoy for War and Peace. There's a novel about massed armies, nations, fate. But go back to Moby Dick for a sec. Part of the genius there was to embody the United States in some sense in that little ship, the Pequod, with a crew of 35 or 40 people in the 1850s. Take that apart, just what Melville did, because people never quite agree about what's the monster, what's he facing? Is it fascism? Is it communism? Is it environmental? Of course, it's an environmental disaster for the whales. But remind us of how many uses Melville puts that book to.
Yeah, at one level, the book is about consumption and the destruction of the natural world. You know, I mean, Melville sketches out with great brilliance how really at that point in time, the people were really just consuming this entire species, you know. And the book is really about one member of the species fighting back. It's extraordinarily moving in that sense, because suddenly Melville saw exactly what you mentioned here, what we are seeing today, that is the non-human world rising up in resistance against the human, you know. But what's also very interesting is that Moby Dick is, as you say, it has a sort of collective subject, and he invokes the subject repeatedly. You'll remember this wonderful chapter where all the crew members are singing, and suddenly it turns out that it's not just a metaphor for America. It's actually a metaphor for the world, because on the Pequod, we discover that the crew of the Pequod consists of like 20 different nationalities, including Indians. India Indians. There are Parsis, there are Alaskas.
And a Pacific cannibal in Queequeg.
Yes,
but also
yes.
The transnation of the nation of many nations was a conception of the United States that's also worth commenting on today. It was a conception of America that we miss in some ways.
Well, I would say it's a conception of the world, really.
Okay.
I think what Melville is deploying there is something much larger than any single nation. And I think that's what's, again, so interesting about him and his work. It opens many doors and windows into our current predicament.
Go back to the inhuman power of these storms, in Sandy especially, maybe. Unbelievable, transcendent power, animated at the same time by accumulations of human activity. We are uncannily related in an intimate way to these storms.
Yeah, Hurricane Sandy is a very good example because, of course, I mean, there have always been very destructive storms. You know, human beings have always faced the fury of nature. But what is different now is that it's not really something apart from ourselves. It's the greenhouse gases that we've added to the atmosphere that gives these storms an extra element of destructive power, you know. So in some sense, it's ourselves revisiting us. So nature is no longer, I mean, nature never was something completely apart. We've always been a part of nature. But since the Enlightenment, you know, people came to conceive of nature as something quite separate from the human. But now we see that we are very much a part of nature, or we are very much a part of our surroundings, very much a part of the Earth system. And we've changed this system in such a way that we are now contributing to these events, which are making the world very much more unpredictable.
Amitav, there's so many other pieces in the book which relate the storms not only to our history and things we've done, but also the history of globalization and trade and world trade. Sounds like a small point, but the fact that Sandy did such destruction to New York and could do it to Boston, or has done variations on it to Mumbai, are all reflections of the fact that sailing nations, imperial nations, built their great cities on the coast. Not the best choice, maybe.
Yes, and that's actually particularly true of British colonialism. The British, being, I suppose, themselves from an island nation, had this great affinity for offshore islands because they built so many of their bases on these offshore islands. So, for example, Mumbai was initially a sort of archipelago of six or seven islands. And today, it's not. It's been sort of filled in so much that it's become a kind of promontory extending out of the mainland. But it's still essentially based on islands. So Mumbai, if you take Manhattan, you take Singapore, you take Hong Kong, all around the world, they really had this affinity for islands because islands were easily defended as far as they were concerned because they had superior naval power. And islands allowed them easy lines of communication with their home bases. But that's one of the interesting things that we are beginning to see now that, you know, maybe building on islands had certain advantages for a colonial power. But these cities are now incredibly vulnerable. It's true of Mumbai, it's true of New York, it's true of Singapore, and it's true of Hong Kong.
You write movingly of this oil encounter. First of all, how we got from coal to oil is the mainspring of industry, but also we don't really look at it. We know where the oil comes from and on we go. You speak of it as very nearly pornographic. The gap of understanding between these two ends of the oil equation are an unspeakable, verging on the pornographic embarrassment. Spell that out. And again, the subject for human understanding that maybe should be a novel. Many novels.
Well, if you just think about it, coal has actually given us so many novels, films, etc. Meitwan is a wonderful film about a coal miner's strike. You think of Victor Hugo. I mean, so many people have written about coal because coal coalesced around the working class. You know, it created these very, very active working class movements. I mean, miners have for a long time now been the leaders of the working class movement. And this was one of the reasons why, after the First World War, the leadership of basically the Anglo-American alliance decided that they wanted to switch to oil because oil is more easily controlled. So Winston Churchill and so on really pushed to convert from coal to oil. And even the Marshall Fund, a lot of the money was actually spent on pushing the conversion from coal to oil. And oil is actually much more easily controlled. Oil requires fewer workers. It moves through pipelines instead of through this overland transportation networks. So curiously, it's actually really interesting to see where is the great novel about oil, you know? Where are the great movies about the oil industry? Yes, there are a couple. But oil has not created as much art as coal has.
I think of you above all as the novelist who made a link over 150 years gap between Britain's opium wars forcing drugs into China, and the American oil wars, especially of the 21st century, Kuwait, Iraq, extended here and there. Oil and opium both begin with O, but they're also driven by a lot of the same free trade, reckless imperial and neo-imperial engines. What are the points where you'd want to say, this has happened before? There are doctrines, there are people, there are forces that are still alive in the world writing our history.
Well, the whole free trade movement, it began in the early 19th century. And basically, it was this free trade ideology that lay behind the opium trade. The first opium war was fought in the name of free trade. It was perhaps the first war to be fought in the name of free trade. And the Iraq war, in some sense, was fought in the name of freedom of trade, and so on. I think people are suddenly beginning to realize that in a completely sort of a free trade kind of world, communities really can't exist. I mean, communities come to be completely diluted. Communities come to sort of fade away. So in many ways, free trade is very destructive of life systems, if you like, you know. Mm. I mean, if you consider, for example, free trade in agriculture, what it's done to farming communities and the reasons why Japan is so fiercely protective of its agricultural systems, because actually family-sized farms can't really compete with these huge industrialized farms that are now so dominant across the world. And people haven't yet found a language in which to speak of their resistance to this kind of neoliberalism. But we have seen over these last few years some movements which are trying to articulate some other points of view. I think Occupy was really a very important movement in that sense. Similarly, you know, now there's a degrowth movement across the world, which is, I think, also making some significant contributions and so on. But it's a reality that the traditional left has now really just melted away.
Coming up, more Amitav Ghosh on the derangement of power, East and West, that brought us to 2016, and witnesses old and new to the convergence here of science, emotion, hearts, and imagination. This is Open Source. Amitav Ghosh, the peripatetic people watcher and novelist, an Indian-born New Yorker, writes as very few can about the human effects of the climate story, East and West, and about two colliding paths into the crisis today.
The issue, though, that really interests me is that this question of global greenhouse gas emissions and so on, it's usually conceptualized by economists and scientists, you know, who see it only as a matter of the economy, of the distribution of wealth. But there's actually a very clear transitive relationship between greenhouse gas emissions and power. Essentially, Western dominance in the late 18th and 19th centuries was built upon the carbon economy, the transition to the use of coal first and then the use of oil. It's no coincidence, certainly, that India and China have really changed their global profiles, essentially by increasing their greenhouse gas emissions, you know. So what we actually see unfolding around us now, at one level, it's a struggle over lifestyles. But at another level, it is a struggle over power.
Who's up? Who's down? What's the contest?
Certainly. I mean, you know, the emergence of China as a global player is very much linked to their industrialization over the last 25 years. And this is true also of India to a much lesser degree, but also of Brazil, also of Russia. Though Russia, of course, has a longer history in that regard. We are at a moment when a redistribution of power is occurring, and it's also creating all sorts of uncertainties. And I think those uncertainties are very much behind this election. You know, we can see one approach to global politics from Hillary Clinton and a completely different approach from Donald Trump. You can see that this redistribution of power has quite fundamentally sort of shaken traditional assumptions about where the power lies.
You have a fascinating quote that I didn't know. Evidently a famous line from Mahatma Gandhi back in 1928, almost 100 years ago, when he was asked about the industrialization prospect in India. And he said, "God forbid that India should ever take to industrialization after the manner of the West. If an entire nation of 300 million people, which is India's population a century ago, if an entire nation of 300 millions took to similar economic exploitation, it would strip the world bare like locusts.
Yes.
Is that part of what's happening?
That is absolutely what is happening. And Gandhi wasn't the only one. He understood this very, very clearly. And he actually took it one step further. He was willing, on behalf of his nation, to make that sacrifice of what is now called economic development. He believed in small village communities, in a village-based economy, and so on. Gandhi saw this quite clearly. So did many Chinese thinkers. So did many thinkers across Asia, and indeed across the world. I mean, Edmund Morris saw this in Britain and in America too. You've always had this pastoralist movement and so on. But all these people were silenced, really, in the West. No major Western politician ever talked about deindustrializing. Whereas, you know, Gandhi was such an important figure in Indian politics. And similarly, some major Chinese figures actually took similar positions. You know, people understood this perfectly well, that an expansion in the living standards of most Asians would make this model of economy untenable. And if Gandhi understood this, I'm perfectly sure also many British and American statesmen understood this. So they realized actually that this kind of lifestyle in the West was only possible so long as other people remained poor. It's not just a matter of wealth or a matter of technology. There is a very significant sort of aspect of power that underlies the whole climate change crisis.
Amitav Ghosh, bring a lot of this history to bear on this American campaign we're staggering through. You write about, for example, the change in the idea of freedom, which has been the American and the Western slogan for centuries now, in a world where storms are this uncanny human, inhuman player against us. It changes the meaning of freedom. Other things, the persistent idea of globalization, which has at the bottom an assumption that the whole world can live this high consumption, sort of American European standard. Other aspects that have brought us, you write, into a sort of vacuum of politics. Oil workers don't have to be dealt with the way the mine workers did, etc. But that the nature of political organization has broken down. Bring all of these trends that you're writing about to bear on what you're seeing in 2016.
It's bizarre. I mean, that's all you can say about it. It's absolutely bizarre when we have so many pressing issues, really. This election has become something that hinges on people's conduct in their bedrooms and so on and so forth. That's actually the point that I'm trying to make in the book, that today politics isn't really about what historically human beings have thought to be politics, which is issues of collective survival, issues of how we create betterment for massive people. What politics has come to be about today is really something about a sort of inner state. It's really about identity, identity conceived of at multiple levels. But even more than that, what democratic politics has really become in the US, most of all, but also in India, is that it's become a spectacle, you know. In fact, what we've ended up in is a machine that actually rules us. We have very little control over this machine, the spectacle is actually controlling us.
You say we live in post-political spaces with a haunting sense of loss. We all know that we're kind of out of it. In Massachusetts, for example, where our votes will barely be counted.
Well, we do have this haunting sense of loss, and it's expressing itself repeatedly in Europe, in Britain, in the United States. One of the things these Trump supporters constantly say is that they have no influence on government. You know, this was also said by the Brexit people. This is also said in Greece. In Greece, we actually saw they held a referendum, and what resulted in the end was completely different from what they intended. You know, the sort of European elites found a way of circumventing what the great majority of the Greeks wanted. Even today in Britain, there's a whole movement which wants to sort of do away with the results of this referendum and go back to what existed before. Similarly, in America, so many people today, so many of the really angry people who are out there, this is exactly what they say, that they feel the sense of impotence, that they are unable in any way to influence their government. And actually, the curious thing is that if you look at the electoral process now, far from responding to that, what the electoral process has become is this sort of what you can only call a kind of media-driven spectacle, you know?
Yeah. You and I were both there, Amitav, in February 2016. 2003, when hundreds of thousands of people tried to gather at the UN and were thwarted by the New York City Police Department, millions around the world, that whole protest against the war never made the New York Times.
Yeah, it wasn't in the New York Times. Such reportage as there was about it hugely underestimated the numbers. That was, for me, really an eye-opening thing, because this was the single largest mass protest that had ever occurred, if you consider all the demonstrations around the world and so on, and it made absolutely no difference. You know, it was just completely swept aside. And now we can see that governments around the world have grown so skilled at just corralling off these protests. They've developed these techniques where they just essentially send demonstrations into places where they have very little visibility and very little impact. Equally, you must have seen just before the Paris climate negotiations, this extraordinary spectacle where the government just swooped down and put like dozens of environmental activists under house arrest. So clearly these lists had already been prepared. They were prepared to act and they acted immediately and they managed to shut down any possibility of a sort of large-scale protest. So we can see now around the world how skilled governments have become at really, as it were, rendering the public impotent, in effect.
What has happened to the fundamental premise that the world can live universally on a standard of modern consumption, on the Western standard of consumption? Appliances, power consumption, waste, environmental damage. Isn't that still the driving idea in what Mrs. Clinton has in mind?
Very much so. That's the extraordinary thing. On the one hand, if we look at politicians around the world, on the one hand, many of them will talk about the climate change issue. I think President Obama really cares about the climate change issue. And yet, at the same time, they're also talking about growth. On the one hand, they're talking about climate change. On the other hand, they're talking about perpetual growth, how to keep growth going all the time. And, you know, growth is essentially a growth in greenhouse gas emissions. So, you know, this is the strange sort of derangement that we have actually ended up in, that we can see this disaster coming towards us. And yet, instead of turning away from it or running away from it, we are accelerating towards it. That's the sort of strange moment that we are at in history.
You make a big distinction, Amitabh, between the spirit and letter of the Paris Agreement on climate change and the Pope's letter. Fascinating to find you plumping for the Pope.
I read the two agreements as a writer. The Paris Agreement, put together by technocrats, billionaires, politicians, and so on, is actually a much, much more speculative and airy-fairy document than the Pope's encyclical. Equally striking is that the Paris Agreement really completely brushes aside the questions of environmental justice, of reparations. I mean, it just permanently closes the door to any sort of reparations for people and the nations that are going to suffer the most from climate change. The Pope's encyclical, on the other hand, is really, it's a marvel of composition. It's so simply and clearly stated, very complex ideas, stated with great lucidity. And as you must know, the Pope actually worked with several climate scientists. He had a whole panel advising him. So the science is actually all there. And yet he's able to find the human aspects of this issue, you know, the issue of justice, of what it'll do to the poor, and, you know, the issue of restitution. And ultimately, he is talking about addressing the whole question of what sort of model are we living with? What sort of model of human existence do we have in mind? Now, these are questions that actually never get asked in the Paris Agreement.
Spell it out. We love definitions of the neoliberal effect and idea.
Well, basically what it is that it's a commercialization of climate change, you know? And that's why so many billionaires were interested in it. Bill Gates, for example, is a huge investor in geoengineering.
And Hillary Clinton says we can become the industrial cure for pollution, of cleaning up the environment.
Actually, that bus has already left. China has now become, by a long shot, the global leader in renewables. The leadership of China saw the potentialities and possibilities of all this very, very early and were very quick to move on it. Because, you know, if you think about it, the American century, the 20th century, was really built to a large extent on Anglo-American control of oil. The reason the dollar became so dominant in the world economy is because it was, in effect, the denominated currency for the oil trade. So it was really the petrodollar, you know. Now, that's one of the aspects of global power that is changing so fast. If China actually manages to become the global power controlling alternative energies, it will significantly boost its standing in the world. It will make it really the leading superpower, you know, and this is something that they've understood and are moving very hard towards.
Would you expect Hillary Clinton to catch up if she became president?
You know, I don't think it's actually in Hillary Clinton's hands. I think we forget, actually, the incredible power of the oil industry.
Yeah.
The oil industry is richer and by orders of magnitude more powerful than any other industry. So actually, you know, what we are not figuring into this is that very rapid move to alternative sources of energy would be a disaster for these huge oil conglomerates. And it's something that they're going to fight tooth and nail and are fighting tooth and nail. This is something which is a very significant factor. I mean, can actually the political leadership of America prevail against corporate leadership? And I think it's quite clear that it really can't. That's why America has been so slow to move to renewables. It could have moved a very long time ago, just as China did. It was the oil industry that essentially held back this possibility.
Amitabh, I'm dying to know what a global anthropologist with as keen an eye as yours, what do you make of the end of this campaign, which centers vociferously around personal sexual scandals, and in it, a volcanic eruption of feeling about injustice over the ages and in our society, particularly to women?
I mean, what can you say? It's at one level, this enormous tragedy. At another level, it's kind of like watching something going wrong inside a funhouse, you know? I mean, it's one can only watch it in appalled horror. But as you say, it's all these other things that are happening as well. These eruptions of protest on matters of race, gender, and so on. And in the background, there is this looming catastrophe, which is not being addressed at all.
Nor other big things that trouble me. The almost abandonment of the egalitarian standard, the way we define American life. But equally, virtually permanent war. There's more talk about climate change in this campaign than about peace in the world as an ideal. I don't know that the word has been mentioned, peace.
Yes, people have sort of given up on that. I mean, let's not forget that Hillary Clinton was one of the prime movers of the Libya campaign.
And signed on to the Iraq War too, of course.
It's almost a certainty now that Hillary Clinton will win the election. And it's by no means an accident that the neocons have gathered around her. Even Rumsfeld has now endorsed her. So I think we are in for several more interventions in the future. Really, she's a borderline neocon. She's a liberal interventionist. We're going to see many more of these in the years to come.
You're right. The public sphere where politics is performed has been largely emptied of content in terms of the exercise of power. As with fiction, it has become a forum for secular testimony, a bearing of the soul in the world as church. Politics as thus practiced is primarily an exercise in personal expressiveness, which is to say not collective expressiveness or decision, a double helix of negation. And you say the internet and the way we talk on the internet speeds it up somehow.
Well, it does, doesn't it? I'm sure if you've been on social media, you've seen how much social media is about, you know, personal expressiveness and so on. But certainly within this election, you see it so clearly. I mean, it's all about politicians' private lives. And of course, I mean, there are very important issues that underlie these scandals and so on. But what is interesting, really, is the way in which such fundamental issues of our collective survival, of our collective well-being, are now completely sidelined.
Sum it up in the terms which, where you began, that quite possibly this era, which so congratulates itself on its self-awareness, will come to be known as the time of the great derangement. We missed the story entirely.
What lies at the heart of this derangement is exactly this, that, you know, we live in an era which fetishizes and worships science. Scientism is everywhere around us. Yet, we are not willing to take on board some very basic predictions that scientists are making, some very basic lessons that they're trying to teach us, that they're desperately trying to convey to us. So that is really the bizarreness of it, you know, that at the same time that we live in a science-worshipping society where everybody is obsessed with techno-progress, if you like, at the same time, you know, what science is so clearly warning us about, we are unable to process it, we are unable to take it on board. So that's absolutely the essence of this derangement, you know.
Amitav Ghosh's bracing last chance call to action from the University of Chicago Press is titled The Great Derangement. Coming up, the London Times naturalist Michael McCarthy and the immortal Alexander von Humboldt join us on a crisis of feeling and imagination. And then the pop prophet Anoni sounds her air of hopelessness in a new release.
I wanna see this world, I wanna see it boil. I wanna see this world, I wanna see it boil. It's only 4 degrees, it's only 4 degrees. It's only 4 degrees, it's only 4 degrees.
Environment, you know, is kind of collapsing around us. Biodiversity is like plummeting around us. And the campaign is just about sex, you know, sex and gender. The conversation is so myopic and reduced. And it's terrifying, given that a third of the Great Barrier Reef died this spring. It's terrifying.
I wanna hear the dogs crying for water. I wanna see the fish go belly up in the sea. And all those tiny creatures, I want to see them burn. It's only for the...
This is Open Source. Amitav Ghosh wants to assign the climate crisis to the creative class on the grand scale of narrative. His models are Tolstoy and Victor Hugo on the aftermath of Napoleon in Russia and in France. Also, Melville on his transnational American whale ships. The Green Thumb historian Andrea Wolf has another model that we barely know, but our man Ralph Waldo Emerson thought the guy was one of those wonders of the world who appear from time to time as if to show us the possibilities of the human mind. Alexander von Humboldt appeared in Germany in the 18th century with a full-blown vision, both scientific and imaginative, of a vitally linked and vulnerable single organism, what we now call the biosphere. Humboldt was Darwin's hero. He was Goethe's friend. Andrew Wolfe brought him alive for us this week on nature, the role of imagination in the sciences, and the peril of environmental ruin.
So Alexander von Humboldt was a Prussian scientist who was really the most famous scientist of his age, born in 1769, and he went on a 5-year exploration through Latin America, during which he came up with a new concept of nature that still very much shapes our thinking today. So he came up with this idea that nature is a web of life. He described Earth as a living organism. And then most amazingly, I think, he warned already in 1800 of harmful human-induced climate change. So more than 200 years ago.
Why are the views of a scientist who died in the year before the release of The Origin of Species, why is he still connected to this world?
I think he's so important because his approach to nature is incredibly relevant again. So we have scientists who've all crawled into their kind of very narrowing disciplines. And Humboldt is someone who is very interdisciplinary. He brings everything together. He fosters the communication between the scientific disciplines. And he also introduces this idea that we should not just measure and observe nature, but also listen to our feelings and use our imagination to understand nature. And I think that's something that's incredibly important at the moment, right now. So I think he's become very, very relevant again.
Build that out, the whole notion that imagination is not a frill, it's not recess, it's everything.
For me, there's something unbelievably beautiful when I read Humboldt's writing. So he comes up with a completely new literary genre because he combines poetic landscape descriptions with scientific observations. And he grabs his readers and takes them into nature, really. And when I look at today's environmental debates in the political arena, such as the climate summit in Paris last year, or the complete ignoring of climate change as in the presidential campaign at the moment, what I'm really missing is that no one is talking about in awe for nature. There's no passionate advocacy for our planet. You know, if we talk about climate change in the political arena, it's mainly dry statistical, technical projections. And I think it's this recognition that we will only protect what we love. And that's something that Humboldt does just amazingly. This creation of a nature around us that is stimulating, that we love, that we like to feel, that we like to understand, that we are very much part of. We are part of this web of life. And that's something that was very, very new at the time, but it's still incredibly relevant today.
We're in this funny bind between unfunny bind between science and anti-science. Science has created the world we live in, including our technology, our cell phones, our lives. At the same time, we don't believe the scientists when they're warning us this thing is in deep, deep trouble.
I was just in Humboldt County 2 days ago, and I...
Where's Humboldt County?
Humboldt County is in California.
Named for your man?
It's named after my man, exactly. So I gave a talk at the Humboldt State University there, but I carved out 4 hours to go for a long hike in the Redwoods. And I've seen the Redwoods before, but it is just so mind-blowingly, amazingly beautiful that you just get put right back into your place of this universe. You know, you feel very small, but you feel in awe. And I don't know, I think we need to be reminded of these things again and again and again. And Humboldt really was a master of that. And he's the first to bring this all together. But at the same time, he also uses hard scientific data. So he's not a romantic who's suggesting to live in kind of misty-eyed harmony with nature. He's someone who also explains this through what he has seen. He says that deforestation, irrigation, and the great masses of steam from the industrial centers will harm our environment and will eventually destroy humankind. So there you have it, more than 200 years ago. We're still not listening to it. That's the drama, really, about it.
Leave us with a little pure Humboldt. What will we remember 30 years from now, forever?
Well, so there's one very, very short sentence he says, which I think is quite extraordinary. So in 1849, so more than 150 years ago, he warned that the restless activity of large communities of man gradually despoil the face of the earth. So we did not listen to that, really, but it still stands as it stands.
Andrea Wolf's ecstatic biography and appreciation of Alexander von Humboldt is titled The Invention of Nature. Michael McCarthy is a celebrated naturalist and Times of London writer who sees this bio breakdown as a profound and beautiful love story gone horribly wrong. He's being celebrated in this country this fall for a memoir and a sort of alarm bell titled The Moth Snowstorm, Nature and Joy. He gave us a taste of it this week in conversation.
When I was a boy, I fell in love with a place, which is a marvelous thing to happen in your youth. And the place I fell in love with was the estuary of a river, the estuary of the River Dee. It's only about 6 or 7 miles from Liverpool, but it was entirely wild, even at that fairly short distance. And it was my first experience of wilderness. The whole of the Dee was on my left hand, at peace in the golden light of October, and I began to hear faint sounds, redshank calls, which go tlu-hoo-hoo. The birds were calling from somewhere invisible to me out on the marshes, but their voices were being carried on the northwest wind, which was blowing straight down the estuary's whole length towards me. And looking at it all, I stopped, sat down on the embankment and listened, and another call drifted to my ears, and it suddenly seemed to be pulling everything together, this ethereal, mournful fluting, all the beauty of the untouched estuary and the great skies and the distant mountains, all its richness of life, and I realised for the first time where it was coming from the very heart of wildness. Whatever it was that had captured the spirit of Thoreau and his successors, looking on the untouched landscapes of 19th century America, in that moment on the Dee estuary captured mine. I saw a part of the earth in a way I'd never seen it before, or perhaps I saw it with a different part of me. Before, had you asked me about it, I would have said that the estuary was broad. It was long. It was flat. It was green. Or sometimes it was wet. Now I would say something different. It was wonderful. I loved it with as intense a love as I had ever experienced. And there, sitting on the embankment in the sunshine and the wind, with the wild calls drifting to my ears, I looked on the natural world and I felt joy.
You write that the 21st century is going to be terrible for the natural world that you've been bound to since boyhood. Spell that out.
In one human lifetime, indeed in my own, the world population doubled from 3 to 6 billion just in 40 years. And now it has added another billion, and by 2050 it will probably add 2 billion more. And this simply means that the pressures on the natural world from the demands of all of us, of every single one of us, are just ratcheted up enormously. And the natural world, which is already suffering gravely, half the rainforests are gone, the beds of the seas are deeply degraded, many fish stocks are at danger levels, 1 in 5 of all vertebrates, which is mammals, birds, fish, reptiles and amphibians, are threatened with extinction. Something really remarkable has happened in my own country of Britain in my lifetime. Britain has wiped out more than half its wildlife since the end of the Second World War. More than half. Hmm. What has disappeared has been abundance. And this is a remarkable phenomenon, the disappearance, indeed the death of abundance. And the metaphor I use for that is the moth snowstorm. In my youth, at night, if you drove down a country lane on a muggy summer's evening in Britain, there would be so many moths and other insects in the air that they would seem like snowflakes in a blizzard in your headlight beams. Mm. And as the faster you drove, the more they would seem. And eventually they would cover your windscreen and they would cover your headlights until you would have to stop and wipe them clear to continue your journey. And many people of my age remember that vividly. And that phenomenon has disappeared. It has gone completely because the moth populations and other insect populations of Britain in the last 40 years have catastrophically crashed.
Amitav Ghosh raises this question, but I put it to you independently. I mean, what is it in our heads, in our collective minds, in our creative minds that is blocking this understanding?
I don't know if you're aware with something that American marine biologists came up with, but the term is the shifting baseline syndrome. What that means is that every generation takes what it sees around it to be normal, right? Mm. So if I walk out into the countryside in England and I see 10 skylarks on my walk, I'll be thrilled. But my parents saw 50 skylarks on their walk, and my grandparents perhaps saw 200 skylarks, and my children may only see 2. But each generation does not realize that the base that came before it was much bigger. So it's harder to see a slimming down of everything, much harder to see a slimming down than a complete disappearance. And what we've had is this great thinning of the wildlife of Britain, and the abundance of wildlife in Britain that we used to have has gone completely. We have in the United Kingdom, and this is not a great advert for anyone who loves nature to come and visit it, but we now have one of the most impoverished wildlife, fauna and flora in the whole world.
Your book is the love story that's gone so wrong, and yet there's a pulse of that love inside it. I mean, introduce that piece of the story.
There is within us a very deep bond persisting between us and nature, which comes from the time when, as hunter-gatherers, we were part of nature rather than farmers who later came to dominate it. And I believe that that bond is still there, and what it shows is that nature is not just a luxury for us, it's not just an optional extra, it's part of us at the very deepest level, and if we lose it and we destroy it, we are destroying an essential part of ourselves.
The moth snowstorm is Michael McCarthy's heartbreaking account of ecological impoverishment, says Helen MacDonald of H is for Hawk, a must read. Anoni is a British-born transgender singer, Oscar-nominated this year for Best Original Song. Hopelessness is her acclaimed album this year, taking aim at the mirage of hope in the Obama years that gave way to drone bombings, NSA overreach, and a deepening environmental crisis. New Yorker magazine critic Hua Shu asks, why doesn't more art aspire to do something that seems impossible? Anoni spoke her mind to me in conversational prose. this week.
Environment, you know, is kind of collapsing around us. Biodiversity is like plummeting around us. And the campaign is just about sex, you know, sex and gender. The conversation is so myopic and reduced. And it's terrifying, given that a third of the Great Barrier Reef died this spring. It's terrifying. America is just completely bewitched with like a really manipulative and deceptive veil of identity politics that appeal to the surface of people's consciousness.
Strange part, we all know that somehow, and we don't demand something else. It's very dark.
I think for me, at the end of the day, just because of who I am, my priority is the well-being of the biosphere and of biodiversity. And that's the thing that's most front in my mind, because I feel like, you know, I've just watched, especially in America, the way that we're manipulated with these other conversations. And I say that, for instance, as a gay or as a transgender person who watched Republican after Republican get elected on an anti-gay, anti-abortion platform in the 80s and in the early 90s. And really what we were electing was neoliberal capitalism. But the working and middle classes were voting to keep gays and AIDS out of their public schools. So it's like there's two currents. There's this popular current that's used to sort of like keep us sated and placated and engaged and outraged. And then there's this deeper current that's actually much closer to the source of our lives, which is about the destruction and depletion and extraction of wellness from the earth. And that is the conversation that we're still incapable of having in America. It's just disgusting at this point. And it's so difficult because it doesn't seem like America really is in the habit of ever really seeing itself clearly, even in retrospect. We're terrible at taking an inventory of who we've been and who we are. Even, you know, just a few years after those crimes against humanity that the Bush administration commit in Guantanamo, it was like Obama was so willing to say that we're not going to be looking back. We're going to look forward. I feel like we're kind of like watching Obama like doing his victory lap, you know, the last few months and rewriting his narrative and telling us all what a good job he did. And I just think he's just another one of the people that just didn't really have the courage to say really enough now is enough. And the environment has just become a kind of a weak tea legacy issue that he's rolling out at the 11th hour with promises of more to come. But it's like we're into decades and decades now of unwillingness to move in a wartime effort to save our planet, which is the only thing that will make any difference, is like a World War II wartime effort to save our world and to save the rest of biodiversity. You know, in our lifetime, we're going to see 50% of the world's species go extinct. You know, we're already seeing like this radical rise in the world's temperatures that was all predicted, and the continued denial and this charade in this election, the extent to which the conversation is oblivious to the real issues that we're facing now, is just, again, it's nothing short of disgusting. That's what's really too awful to me, is just the plunge into silence while we're busy thinking about other things, things that won't matter in 100 years. All anyone will be asking is, what were they doing with nuclear stuff? What were they doing with fossil fuels? How did they manage to convince themselves that this wasn't worse than genocide, the activities that they were participating in so mundanely to supposedly take care of their basic needs? You know, in 100 or 200 years, that people would just be mind-boggled at the systems of denial that we employ to keep moving forward.
But hopelessness, she said at the close of our call, is not the end, and it's not quite despair.
I take a lot of inspiration from Indigenous communities. The Native American community is turning it out in North Dakota in the last few months, and the gesture of selflessness with which they advocate for clean water for all people is just such a far cry from our Western model, which is to advocate for our own interests. In order for effective change to take place, we're all going to have to disengage collectively en masse immediately. It's an almost unfathomable transformation, and yet the consequence of not doing it is so much more profound than what's being asked of us. The stakes couldn't be higher, and if you look at it that way, it couldn't be a more exciting time to be alive. What did you have to gain?
Thank you, Anoni, and Michael McCarthy, Andrea Wolf, and Amitav Ghosh. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, Frank Horton, Becca DiGregorio, and Susan Coyne. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon, and it's a great time to be alive on Open Source.